Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. James Howard Kunstler is a prominent social critic, drawing attention through his writing and speaking to the global oil crisis, climate change, and other converging catastrophes of the 21st century. His World Made by Hand series has become a cult sensation. A History of the Future is the third installment of this series, and an exploration of family and morality is played out in Union Grove during a winter when celebration mixes with tragedy. James Howard Kunstler is the author of 12 novels and several works of nonfiction, including The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic. It is a pleasure to welcome him to The Book Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
Jim, always good to see you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Quite welcome.
At what point did you realize, when you started to write these World Made by Hand novels, that it would be a series? It would be something that you would want to continue?
From the very outset, I planned to write one book each based on the four seasons. I've been proceeding regularly ever since. For me, writing is like making bratwurst. You just sort of churn out one link after another, and I'm not neurotic about it. I just go to the screen, get it done. So I really wanted to write kind of a comprehensive history of the future, so to speak. You know, that has now become the title of the third installment of this series. In order to do that, I knew that it would take more than one book, because I want to cover a lot of territory.
Is it safe to say that there is a message, that it's a message book?
In the sense that my original intent, after writing a very disturbing nonfiction book, The Long Emergency, about the uncertain prospects for the human project going forward with our problems with fossil fuels and our overgrown, overshot population and all of our resource problems. I wanted to find another way to get to this audience, and I wanted to find a way to reassure people that life would probably go on, except that it would be a lot different. And so I use my imagination to create this fictional world of the post-economic collapse, post-petroleum American future. It's set in a small town in upstate New York. And what I discovered was that the circumstances of daily life are very different, but American culture continues. There is continuity in this world. It comes in the form of culture rather than economy.
And I know we've talked about this before, but in these books, the world that you write about, where are we in the long emergency?
Oh, well, we're kind of at the outset. You know, we're kind of at the bottom of the first inning, I think, and waiting for a lot of things to shake loose. And we have managed to kind of artificially keep our economy going by using debt to pay for stuff now by taking from the future. But that can only go on so long. And, you know, my basic idea, I think, in the nonfiction sort of reporter sense, is that the financial system, being the most fragile of all of the complex systems we depend on for a daily life, you know, which include agribusiness and, you know, big box commerce and et cetera, that finance and banking being the most fragile system, it's probably going to be the one that fails first. And as it does, it's going to affect all the other systems, including the way we grow our food, the way we move around the terrain, the way we do commerce. You know, all these things are going to be affected pretty deeply by failures in the money system.
So in the novel, where are we in the long emergency?
We're actually, things have settled down after a great period of turmoil.
Seventh inning stretch, to keep up the analogy?
The seventh inning stretch is good. Yeah. There are many references to an event that's referred to as the Holy Land War. Other events like the great collection of broken cars and metal and materials that are needed to prosecute this war. The electricity is not working anymore. The internet is gone. Many institutions have failed, even the court system, which plays a prominent role in all of these books, but particularly in this third installment where a murder has taken place. And the people in town are having a very hard time prosecuting this murder and going, you know, creating an institutional flow of events that will allow them to process this event.
It is so relatable. I guess that's what's scary about it, is that it's not that hard to relate to.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really consciously wanted to do was to create a world of textures and flavors and sensations that people could understand and that would get into their brains in a different way than a nonfiction book. And I really wanted to get across the idea that the future would be different, but there would be many compensations for the losses that we had incurred, you know, from having lost the internet and having lost cheese doodle manufacturing line of agribusiness products and our cars and all that, that, you know, for instance, people would get to know their neighbors better, work shoulder to shoulder with them, make music with them, would be much more in touch with the daily rhythms of natural life, you know, the seasons, the rising and setting of the sun, be much more in touch with their own family and friends. And that led to a lot of interesting discoveries that, you know, occur in a kind of emergent synergistic way when you're making fiction, because it's a self-informing emergent process. And, you know, one of the things I discovered, for example, is that people had to be very polite to each other in a future world where there was very little law enforcement and, you know, very little social armature for enforcing behavior. If you're living in a society where pretty much anything can happen to you, you've got to be very careful. So as a consequence, you know, having written many other novels where people speak in the contemporary vernacular, right, you know, there's very little swearing in this novel. And that surprised me, the way that worked out. And it became kind of a conscious thing. And one of, you know, another thing that I realized very close to the outset of the first book was that, you know, people wouldn't be riding around on bicycles. And a lot of people were twanging on me after the first book came out. They were very disappointed, you know, the eco people. You know, they couldn't believe that people weren't riding around on bicycles now that the car was gone. As soon as I really thought about it, when in the first chapter, I realized, you know, they wouldn't be able to get the replacement parts, that the complex metallurgy that's necessary to make all these, you know, gear shift components and brake components and tubular metal, it wouldn't be there for them. Plus, the pavements would all be broken up and there wouldn't be a decent surface to ride on. So this world continues to emerge and shape itself as I go along, and it's constantly surprising me.
In that shaping process, a lot of things have been taken away. This is the way it was. This is the way it is now. And it's much different. Whatever saying you use, whether it's, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, or it's let the genie out of the bottle, it's a new tube of toothpaste and it's a new bottle.
Yeah, one of the things that I did to kind of illustrate that is I paid a lot of attention to the cuisine of the world made by hand, you know, what people are eating, because that's something you have to do, you know, a few times a day, and you got to do it every day to keep on going. And I figured that would be an interesting illustration of how things had changed. And one of the things they're always complaining about is that they only have cornbread, you know, because wheat won't grow in the region, you know, the Northeast, because of a persistent stem rust disease in the soil that's been here for hundreds of years. And so they're always complaining about that. But I went to great lengths to describe the things on their tables. And I thought that was a good way of getting to people's brains. Having worked in restaurants in my 20s and 30s when I was a starving bohemian writer, I actually knew a thing or two about how to, you know, cook stuff. So it was possible to do that.
James Howard Kunstler is our guest. The new novel is A History of the Future, a World Made by Hand novel. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. In writing about Union Grove, you wanted to explore a small village as opposed to a city. And if I'm reading the novels properly, it's your idea that this is a better way of living.
Well, not just that. I'm very firm and serene in my conviction that our big cities are going to get in a lot of trouble, as much trouble as suburbia, and that they're gonna be rather disorderly places as time goes by. And the places that will be more successful will be the smaller towns, the smaller cities that are scaled to the resource and energy and capital realities of the future, which are going to require us to live at a much smaller scale. And the places that are close to food production, the places that have some kind of a meaningful relationship with farming, that cuts a lot of places out right there. In this book, A History of the Future, for the first time I've kind of opened it up and had a character travel a long way out of town. The son of the protagonist in the first book journeys from eastern upstate New York, Union Grove in Washington County, all the way out to the Great Lakes, and has several adventures along and misadventures along the way, and ends up being sent down to Tennessee, where a breakaway republic of a kind of white supremacist flavor, led by a former TV evangelist / country singer, a lady, has formed. And he's sent down there on a mission to get to know, shall we say, the leader of this Foxfire Republic, as they call their new country. And I like to refer to that central episode as Dolly Parton meets Hitler.
Loving Morrow.
Yes, Loving Morrow is the former country singer, now turned president of the Foxfire Republic, this breakaway republic formed of Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, Arkansas, and the Carolinas. And they're perpetually at war with another breakaway republic, calling itself New Africa, composed of Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, led by a former check-cashing mogul named Milton Steptoe. And they're fighting over Atlanta and Chattanooga at the moment. Loving Morrow is trying to lay siege to Cincinnati so that she can control the river traffic on the Ohio River. And those are the circumstances that young Daniel Earle walks into when he rides down into the Foxfire Republic.
Back in Union Grove, you were talking a moment ago about how you included murder in this book. And this is a young mother who is ill and kills her husband and her infant child.
Yeah, her son.
Her son. Why did you want to include that to allow you to explore not only the justice system that you mentioned earlier, but how these other issues play into that as well?
Well, because a continuing issue in all three of the books is how does a society deal with the failure of its institutions? And in this case, the law has basically failed. You know, there's really very little law enforcement, and the courts are not operating. And yet life goes on, things happen, and the people have to manage. So I wanted to show how the people of Union Grove might contrive to deal with this rather terrible problem. And one of the central problems is that the woman is really kind of, I guess, legally insane. She's been through a bout of meningitis, which has affected her mind pretty severely. And she's carried out this double murder of, you know, her husband and her son. There's no place to put her, really. There aren't any, even if she is tried, and if they manage to have a trial, a grand jury and a trial, and actually make this thing happen, they don't know what to do with her, even if she's found, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. There are no institutions left to place people in. So that becomes an issue, and eventually is resolved.
And we see a legal system. We read about a magistrate in this book. So there's a new system.
Yeah, there's sort of a new system. The magistrate himself is a wealthy planter named Stephen Bullock, and he's been in all three books. He's kind of a model of how one way of organizing a big agricultural business might work in a post oil world. And the model that he is living out is basically feudalism. You know, he has become the American version of a kind of 13th century feudal lord. A lot of the people who have failed around the county, you know, in one vocation or another that no longer exists, you know, selling insurance or being a pharmacist or, you know, doing this or that, they have come under his wing, and he's taken them in to work on his farm and provided cottages for them to live on, and a sense of an orderly life in a time which is very disorderly and disturbing for a lot of people. And he's been elected magistrate sort of against his will, because he's one of the most powerful people in the town and the county. but you know, his power is very limited. He happens to be a lawyer, though he hasn't practiced in 30 years, and he takes up this job. And he says, you know, somebody is talking to him about the law and complaining about how poorly it's working. And he says, look, we're making it up as we go along now.
Right.
You know, the old forms, the old procedures and protocols, they're not here anymore for us.
When I was reading the novel, I highlighted this part of the book from later in the novel. Is where he says, as magistrate, I'm the only force standing between chaos and the orderly regulation of daily life around here. Now we've got a capital murder case that begs to be tried expeditiously in the name of due process and justice, lest the people get the idea that we exist in a state of savagery. Am I being clear?
Yeah, he likes to be clear. He's a forceful guy, but he's also very pig-headed about what he intends to do. And one of the things that he seems to be set on is hanging this woman. And his clear and strong intention becomes a big problem for trying that case.
I do want to talk about something that you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, and that is the idea to explore the season. So what this book, it's winter, it's around the holidays. What talk a little bit about what that afforded you and what exploring the four seasons has allowed you to do.
Well, it's Christmas time, and in fact, it's 2 days before Christmas when the book opens, and I wanted to depict this post-oil, post-economic collapse world as being a place where you could still celebrate Christmas. It just wasn't all electrified, and it didn't mean that you're making repeated trips to the chain store to get a lot of swag to give to your relatives, you know? And it's actually quite festive. And, you know, the setting of this book, the opening of this book, I'm trying to show people that this little world of a small town in upstate New York is actually very is full of festivity, and you know, people are the bakery actually has things in the window that are enticing to people, and people are having parties and festivals, and people are going about with decorations in their hats, and you know, even the horses have got holly berries in their cruppers, and you know, it was another way of getting people to understand that life will go on, and actually that, you know, joy and happiness can be found in a world without a $3.80 fill up at the gas tank, and you know, going around all the seasons. The first book took place in the late spring, early summer. And, you know, that was a world that filled people with the sensations of, you know, being, you know, all this stuff in the air and the flowers blooming and the crops growing and the things that they had to do to process the food that they came by. The second book took place in the fall, and it was the harvest season, and it was Halloween. And it was a spooky book about very spooky, dangerous people. In the second book was called The Witch of Hebron. And so that allowed me to really kind of ramp up the atmospherics, especially because the electricity is not going, people aren't driving around in cars, and, you know, they're living in a world that is actually much more like Sleepy Hollow than we are. The third book takes place at Christmas. That's a history of the future, the one we're talking about. And the one I'm working on now, the fourth one, takes place during that period of time in this late spring that used to be known around here as the 6 weeks want. And that'll probably be the title of that book. And that's the period of the year when you've run out of last year's preserved food and the new stuff hasn't come along enough to eat it.
Right.
That's, you know, like May, early June. And you know, the greens have barely sprouted out of the ground, and yet you've run out of potatoes and onions.
How much, and I get this idea in reading the book, that for you this is a part a cautionary tale and part utopia.
Well, in a way, yeah, I'd say that's true. You know, there's something kind of awful about living in this cracking up turbo techno-industrial civilization. Certainly, most of us are comfortable with the idea that if we could only continue living the way we are now, that everything would be fine. I have never believed that that was going to be the prospect for us. And I think that it's really necessary to imagine what lies on the other side of that next phase of history. For me, it was important to try to get comfortable with that. And I wanted to try to make other people comfortable with the way we're going to be living in the decades into the future. And in order to do that, I had to hang that idea on a lot of dramatic action, you know, made up incidents, which I've been doing. That's how fiction is written. And you know, that's how you introduce your own agenda into a piece of fiction.
And as you say, you have never failed to be surprised of where this brings you. And I assume that's through a process of thinking it through, of what would be the reaction in this new world to a situation like this.
Well, for me, I don't know. The writing process is rather mystical for me, and I'm not really that much into the cosmic woo-woo of things, you know? But for me, it's a strangely mystical thing, and I will be faced with the prospect of having to write a scene. I sort of know what it's about, but I don't really know how it's going to work. And then I'll be doing something completely different, you know, riding my bike, you know, up the backside of the Battenkill or something. And I will, the thing will spring to me full blown. There have been a number of very strange incidents that occurred, though. After I moved out to Greenwich, New York, in Washington County. It's about 35 miles northeast of Albany. I moved there from Saratoga in 2011 after I had finished the first two books. And there's a central character in all these books named Brother Job. He's the leader and head honcho of a religious cult that's come up from the South to try to find some peace and tranquility in a different part of the country. And I had the strange experience the first month after I moved to Greenwich of walking past a little plaque in a little park in the center of town. And there was a plaque devoted to the founder of the town whose name was Job.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, that is really peculiar. And I named the little village Union Grove. And after I moved to Greenwich, I discovered very accidentally that the town of Greenwich had been called Union for about 40 years, between about 1820 and 1865.
Union Village, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was weird. And just the other day, a very strange thing happened. There's a sort of a set piece or a chapter or an incident at the end of this book, A History of the Future, where a young man discovers the abandoned Penny Saver newspaper office and goes in there and is inspired to take it over, clean it up, and think about putting out a newspaper. And the other day, I went by the old newspaper office in Greenwich, and there's a young guy cleaning up the office and cleaning up the building about to start a print shop. Right. And I just thought, you know, this is very weird. This is like, Oscar Wilde's old idea that life imitates art. So I don't know. You know, personally, I'm not really that cosmic. You know, I'm not very religious, and I don't, you know, really subscribe to a lot of New Age stuff. But the process of writing is very, very weird, kind of, you know, tuning into the transmitter up there.
Well, the new novel is A History of the Future. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. James Howard Kunstler, it's always a pleasure to have you aboard. Thank you very much, and best of luck with the new novel.
Thank you very much, Joe, and I'll see you back here for number 4 in about, I don't know, 18 months maybe.
I look forward to it.
Okay.
Again, the title of the book is A History of the Future. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.